Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Evening's drawing in. The curl of blue wood smoke on an open fire. It was 1999 when we first laid eyes on the apple tree. We'd been searching for a piece of land where we could grow things. It had to be within 3 hours' drive of Dublin. So with a pencil and compass, we traced a curve across an ordnance survey map and began to search along the line till we ended up in East Mayo. It was a process of elimination. Too rushy, too dark, too close to a loud road. And then we found one that was just right. A triangular site spanned by a small river. The hawthorn was in a froth of pink and white, and every field and cranny was exploding with the first green flush of summer. We clambered over walls and fences to wade through the long grass, engaged in the age-old activity of walking the land. The site had been carved into a maze of hills and dips by sand quarrying, and the resulting topography lent itself to flights of fantasy, the creation of our family mythscape. One hollowed-out corner looked like a small amphitheatre, with a hawk's plucking stone at the centre. Hidden from the narrow road by horse chestnut trees which towered from the old hedgerow, a curved stone wall looked enticingly like a ring fort. A recess in the stonework was roofed by a rectangular slab, suggestive of an ancient burial site, but which we later learned had been a goose house. Taking a path around a hummock we would come to refer to as the Nookawn, we got our first sight of her. The most perfectly formed apple tree, laced with pale grey-green lichen and festooned by fronds of fern. The base had divided into two about 18 inches from the ground and grown into twin trunks which between them created a symmetrical canopy of graceful branches, each one weighed down by trusses of blossom. She filled the space like a living orb, a circle of dappled shade on the ground beneath her. Judging by the girth of the trunk, unusually large for an apple tree, she must have been planted over a century ago, when the site was a busy working farm. Later, when contracts were signed and we had settled in, my husband sent water shoots from the trunk of the old apple to seed savers. And in due course, we received 6 small trees grown by whip and tongue grafting. Unable to identify the variety, we called it the Oldcastle Bell. Her fruit is cylindrical in shape with a dryish skin and ripens from a pale yellow to a rosy blush as the season advances and the dense flesh turns crisp and juicy. We planted fritillaries and bluebells beneath the canopy and put a seat at her feet, a quiet place to sit and watch butterflies spiral in their mating dance. A tip-fruiting variety, the Oldcastle Bell's apples hang on tight to the very ends of branches until late autumn, bouncing in the strong winds and torrential rain so common in these parts. But in 2018, the morning after Storm Eleanor had swept across the country, making our window panes shake in their frames, we were greeted by the garish sight of bright white applewood on a torn stump, where one half of the old tree had cleaved away. Spilt blood could not have been more shocking. The half tree continued to bloom and to fruit, though less vigorously, and over time slender water shoots emerged from the fracture. But the symmetry was gone. Then this September, the surviving half too collapsed. I don't know what will appear in the glade now that the enchanting bower is no more. But the 6 grafted Oldcastle Bells fruit prolifically, and the apples are a favourite of the rooks and jackdaws who descend in flocks to tug them off the trees. We have put the fruit in crumbles, baked it, turned it into compote, but the Oldcastle Bell is best eaten just as it is. Somehow the loss of the perfect apple glade hurts less when I write it down. And what is perfection but a moment in time, tasted and gone as quickly as a white-fleshed apple, sliced paper-thin and share it with someone you love.
It's one of the quirks of life that events that hold a huge importance for any of us can go unremembered by others who shared them. And moments that are of great significance to others have long evaporated from our memories. There are hugely important moments in my life about which I have only the vaguest of recollections. And there are relatively minor events that are still crystal clear after decades. One such memory that remains is of a dull, wet, miserable afternoon in November of 1965. We were crammed into a classroom in St. Clement's College in Limerick, heads bent over poetry books. Our English teacher, Ray Kearns, perched on the edge of a desk, trying to interest us in the poem we were about to study. He probably talked about the author, about the background to the work, about the things we should look out for as we read. None of that remains in my memory. All were inconsequential to the boy I was. But then he began reading, and I was transfixed by the opening lines. I walked through Ballinderry in the springtime, when the bud was on the tree. And I said in every fresh ploughed field, beholding the sowers striding free, scattering broadside forth the corn in golden plenty on the quick seed-clasping soil. I had no interest at that time in what the poet Samuel Ferguson said in the succeeding lines, or indeed in the story of Thomas Davis. It was the one opening sequence of images that had caught my attention and imagination. And in that moment, I fell in love with the idea of poetry, and with the sudden revelation that a poem can illuminate a wretched, rainy Tuesday afternoon. I had no idea where Ballinderry was, but I did know about spring, and I knew about the sowing of the seeds in the fields around my home place of Castledermot. The sowing might then be done by machines, but the fields of my childhood were still peopled by men, women and children who picked stones and weeded and thinned beet. And for a homesick boy, in his first term in secondary school, the thought of walking through familiar fields in springtime, the memory and hope of seeing the trees in bud, the possibility of stumbling across the ploughed ground of Dempsey's or Keatley's fields, was a liberation from the loneliness of boarding school. In those moments, my classmates disappeared. The winter rain and dull afternoon dissipated. The schoolroom walls crumbled, and I was transported to a different time and place. Winter was over. Classes were done with. Enclosure was a memory. I was out in the open air. I was traversing a familiar path and a field. I was clearing the little river in one jump. I was climbing over a rusty iron gate. I was touching the sticky sap of a sycamore bud. I was marvelling at the colours of the newly ploughed sods. I was watching the farm labourers, men who lived on our road from the headland. On that wintry afternoon, even as a 13-year-old, I had an exciting and revelatory realisation of the power of words, images, phrases, to transport and to alter the now into the then, the here into another, better, more cheerful place. No doubt, as we read through Ferguson's poem, the classroom walls closed in again. The rain continued to fall against the grimy windows, and we were given homework that afternoon, before trooping on to our next class and later to the study hall and eventually to night prayer. But something had changed. And a door had been opened, knocked off its hinges even, and I had fallen in love with the possibility of the word. not in a biblical sense, but in the way an expression, a sound, a picture can change everything and offer possibilities that weren't there a moment before. Poems became more than lines to be memorized. Stories took on the ability to transport and offer insight. Words became more than mere collections of letters. And Ballanderry became a new name for liberty and inspiration.
I never knew the eminent psychiatrist R.D. Lang. I don't know what he did before or after his famous appearance on The Late Late Show, but as a 15-year-old, I was gripped. I'd no idea what a fourth wall looked like, but when Gayburn broke it by asking the question, we were all thinking about just what this guest had had to drink before coming on his show. The heated discussion which followed became one of the standout TV moments of my childhood. I was an only child. That probably explains a lot. In the bathroom mirror of our house in Newry, I used to interview myself on The Late Late. Well, Gay, that's a great question. I imagined a future where the details of my fascinating life and glittering career would have a national audience glued to their seats on a Friday night, because it was the biggest show in town. I envied Gay sitting at his desk in front of a succession of storytellers like the great actor Peter Ustinov recounting a long and winding story, including a perfectly observed, detailed impersonation of a Ukrainian railway official. Neil Tobin effortlessly slipping from county to county, poking fun at the Cork men and the Cavan men and the Nordies. Billy Connolly, like a bold child. The red-faced audience member in his best beige jacket, jabbing a finger towards the presenter, raging about the declining moral standards in Ireland. And behind him, Bridie from Ballymahon, the pride of the parish, waving to everybody at home, beside herself to be on The Late Late Show at last. And straight after the show, you knew Bridie would be loading the goodies into her Toyota Starlet to head for home. One for everybody in the audience. Enfant Terrible, Bob Geldof, Ferdia McKenna, Grumpy Old Men, Hugh Leonard, Ulick O'Connor, Dublin Can Be Heaven, A Pint of Plain, Soap Your Arse and Slide Backwards Up a Rainbow, and off to bed. The Late Late was the conversational currency of our weekends. Then I moved to Belfast, a bit further out of reach of RTE. And one night, I came to realise that not everyone was aware of this extraordinary phenomenon. I presented a concert which went out live on BBC Radio 3. The Ulster Orchestra was conducted by a brilliant Kerry man called Robert Houlihan. Just before the final piece, my producer said, "Go out on stage and fill with Bobby for 2 minutes or so." Bobby was delighted to get the chance to chat and enthusiastically began to plug his new series of CDs to a packed house in the Ulster Hall. Now, I was conscious that this was going out right across the UK and that listeners in Chipping Norton or Clonetley mightn't be as interested, and the BBC bosses certainly wouldn't want to hear a shameless, if entertaining, plug for Bobby's latest commercial venture. So in an attempt to draw the conversation to a close, I said, "Wow, Bobby, sounds like you've a car boot full of CDs up in Belfast with you tonight. Sure there's one for everybody in the audience." Bobby laughed, I laughed, and said, "So let's hear the final piece. It's the Hungarian Dance No. 1 by Brahms, the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Robert Houlihan." They played, he conducted, we got the programme over the line and handed back to Broadcasting House in London. Job done. As the audience slipped away into the chilly Belfast night and the musicians and crew were packing up, someone said, "There's a lady wants to talk to you there at the front of the stage." And there, sure enough, was a small delegation of women with good coats on. "We really loved the show," they began, "particularly the concerto." "Oh, thanks very much," says I. We were just wondering, where do we pick up the CDs? The CDs? I said. Yes, you said there was a CD for everybody in the audience.
I did, yes, that's right. That was, you see, there's this TV show called The Late Late Show. They continued to smile in their buttoned-up coats.
On RTE, presented by Gay Byrne, not a flicker. And every week he gives away stuff like hampers or holidays to the audience.
It's like a catchphrase, you know, one for everybody in the audience. So there's no CDs.
By the time I'd said, no, sorry, that's my fault, it's a misunderstanding, they had thanked me and were out the door. Gayburn's charm and that unique Late Late Show mix of entertainment and controversy mightn't have had people talking in quite every corner of Ireland. But for those of us in the know, we knew. Thanks, Gay.
My friends, please hear me do. I've got a message just for you.
My friend Eddie Jordan phoned. I hadn't heard from him for years. When I was 20, and he a little younger, we headed off to Paris with a few quid, no job and no return tickets. It was a life-changing experience. We drifted apart over the years, but were always only a phone call away. Then in June 2008, Eddie called. His 50th birthday was approaching, and he thought he'd like to do something a bit different. He explained that the American artist Spencer Tunick, renowned for his large-scale outdoor nude photography, was inviting people to pose for him on the South Wall in Dublin. Eddie was thinking it would be a great way to celebrate his milestone. Go for it, I said. The thing is, he said, I don't fancy going alone. If Eddie was 50, I was a bit older and long past getting my kit off in public. But a friend in need and all that, so I agreed. It sounded just like the old days. I decided I'd better get a new pair of jocks. It had been 6 months since Christmas, after all, and a pack of four wouldn't go astray. Before I knew it, we were standing on the cold stone of the custom house, with crowds of strangers waiting for double-decker buses to ferry us to the South Wall. I dreaded the thought of meeting someone I knew. It was 4 a.m. when we filed off the buses. We were directed to where we should wait until instructed to undress before walking naked to our final destination. Eddie suggested we stand by a pole. It would make it easier to find our clothes in among 2,500 bags when it was all over, so we made camp. Never one to idle, he then announced he was going walkabout and abandoned me. After 60 seconds alone, even with everybody fully clothed, I felt completely out of place. Around me were couples and groups of friends, and here was I, the 50-something balding sad bloke, turning up to a group nude gig all on his tod. After an eternity, Eddie returned. The system was working, he announced. He couldn't spot me, but he knew the pole. Great, I said. And then he introduced me to two young women. They'd got talking, and then one of the women suggested they three should stick together. Then the young couple beside us explained they weren't a couple at all and wondered could they join our ever-growing group, and why not, we asked. We spoke about our reasons for being there. I said I was only there because Eddie used emotional blackmail. The two younger women said they loved the whole idea of the photo shoot and they just couldn't wait to begin. It made me feel even more self-conscious, a condition I'm not normally prone to. Finally, as the light improved, the announcement came and the young women waited no longer. Everyone was naked in seconds, and in our nudity we were all equal. Except, of course, some were more equal than others. To get over any awkwardness, we six all agreed to have a good gawk at each other and then started the cold walk along the wall. Everyone was being very well behaved, as we stood terribly close to each other, waiting for Mr. Tunick to approve the light so the shoot could begin. Then a very large passenger ferry appeared, with a deck full of people viewing the horizon. What a view they got. 2,500 naked bodies started waving at them. Giddiness galloped through the crowd, and we all started to do a Mexican wave. Before we knew it, the rising sun was competing with a group moon. No, I'm not proud of it, but it happened. The participants were never really the same after that. And when that photo shoot was over, Mr. Tunick invited anyone who wasn't frozen to death to take part in a second shoot on the beach. We six looked at each other and all nodded, one for all and all for one. By the time that shoot was over, we were jumping around singing Olé, Olé, Olé. Finally, freezing wet and elated, we made our way back to our trusty pole and dry clothes. People moved hurriedly, and within minutes we were all dressed and refreshed. That's when I noticed her, a young woman moving quickly through the fully clad crowd, looking for her clothes. In a few moments, everything had changed. She was no longer part of a congenial crowd. She was an outsider, naked and being stared at. Her head was lowered as she scrambled between people's feet, with clearly no idea where she had left her bag. As she reached us, I remembered I still had three pairs of boxers in the packet. Half embarrassed, I offered them. They're brand new, I told her. I don't think she cared. She grabbed a pair and quickly put them on. Then Eddie offered a big spare towel. She flung it over her shoulder like a shawl, thanked him and continued with her search, a little less frantic, a little less noticeable, and finally, not visible at all. I often think of that young woman, and I hope her memories of the day are as happy as mine. And I hope her experience made a great story about how she came to be wearing a strange man's boxer shorts.
I'd like to build the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves. I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. I'd like to hold it in my arms and keep it
company. Autumn's unfurling into winter means letting go, watching the leaves shed their summer coats. But for a short time, the abundance of the season is held in the ditches as the blackberries ripen. Maybe what sends me out to pick them is some deep hunter-gatherer instinct. Or maybe it's the memory of autumns gone by and the juiciness of childhood nostalgia held in these black knots of deliciousness. These little berries soften the blow of the swallows leaving. They are bites of sun-warmed sweetness to fend off the dawning realization that soon it will be time to draw the curtains and light the fire against the dark chill of winter. But there's something I savour more than the taste of the fruits themselves. The day that my mother and I go for our annual expedition to gather them. We never venture far from home. There are rich pickings literally on our doorsteps. That doesn't mean there won't be much discussion about the trip. We only embark on it once my mother has done a thorough reconnaissance mission of the local lanes and back roads. She designates the spot, and together we will decide the day. For some reason, she always declares it a bumper year for the crop. Even as I feel the year ebbing away, and the gnawing of my own heart at time's relentless march, like the dragonfly who has only one day of blessed summer to soar, I give myself over completely to the art of blackberry picking. I have a vivid memory of the nature table in primary school. Because most of us walked to school, children dropped their treasures on it as they came into the classroom. A snail's iridescent shell, an acorn, the spiky outer husk of a conker, and blackberries, somewhat squashed, had been held in a child's warm hand. the blackberry picker would be easily identified by the telltale stains which would remain on their hand for the rest of the school day. Now the honeysuckle fuchsia lines the edges of the roads, its petals dripping down over the ditches like elegant scarlet ballerinas. Clustered among them, in between the ferns and nettles and ragwort, are the ripe, juicy and inky treasures we seek. The words of Seamus Heaney from his much-loved poem Blackberry Picking spring to my mind as I scour and gather. You ate that first one and its flesh was sweet, like thickened wine. Summer's blood was in it, leaving stains upon the tongue and lust for picking. Some branches yield their fruit easily, and soon the bottom of my container is covered. Others do not give up their bounty so readily, and if I'm not careful, the thick, thorny limb of a briar will reach out to remind me that this is their territory, that I am greedy, that I need to slow down and be patient. As my mother and I talk, I am conscious of trying to hold the fruits of these conversations with the same care as I fill my pot full of blackberries. Stories of the way her mother would pick berries, or how to make sure you know the exact setting point of jam, punctuate the delicious silences. The years slip by, and I am a girl once more, looking up to my mother with her seemingly limitless knowledge of the world of ditches and berries and all the things that grow. We always laugh at my constant overreaching, and she cautions me against precariously balancing on a high ditch. I become again the girl who managed to catch every single dress on briars and tear holes in the clothes she sent me out in. All too soon, our containers are full and we call it a day, bringing our cash home to wash, eat and store. Sometimes I cook up a batch with a little honey and sugar to freeze for barren winter mornings when I want the taste of nature's plenty. Sometimes I even set myself the ambitious task of making jam. It hasn't turned out too badly in the past. But these after occurrences are not the point. Nothing comes close to reaching out and tugging a berry from a branch, hearing the soft and satisfying thud as it falls on the others, and seeing my container fill with the blackness of jewelled fruits. The time spent with my mother, as we work our way steadily along a stretch of road, looking for a clutch of rich blackberries, is a reminder that the best things in life are free if we stop and take the time to savour them. A small, hand-picked harvest becomes a rich memory store.
When I was growing up in London, my parents' friend Carlos was an exotic presence in our lives. A diamond dealer from Eastern Europe, he had a thick Hungarian accent that made him sound like Dracula. His memorable response to someone's suggestion that he consider reconciliation with his ex-wife went down in family lore. The only thing worth warming up is cabbage. Loved by men and women, he had two magnificent daughters to support further this illusion of mystery. For, as a child, Carlos had been rescued by Raoul Wallenberg, a Swedish diplomat who had saved thousands of Jews from deportation by the Nazis in the summer of 1944. Although a Nazi puppet regime was installed in Hungary for most of the war, its Jewish population had been left relatively unmolested. Such leniency eventually became intolerable to Hitler, who ordered his henchman, Adolf Eichmann, to round up Hungary's 800,000 Jews and send them to Auschwitz. Overnight, a ghetto was constructed in Budapest, incarcerating 60,000 men, women, and children. An SS officer on horseback rode through the main synagogue, the largest in Europe, and smashed the Torah scrolls. Every trace of Jewish life was to be eradicated. The ultra-fascist Hungarian Arrow Cross would do Hitler's bidding and began a merciless campaign of terror against the Jewish population. But amidst the ensuing chaos and fear, some unlikely saviors stepped forward. The Swedish diplomat Raoul Wallenberg worked ceaselessly to issue Swedish papers to as many Jews as possible, as did Karl Lutz, a Swiss official who is credited with saving as many as 62,000 Jews by giving them the protection of Swiss neutrality. Both men are honored as righteous among nations in the Garden of Remembrance in Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. But perhaps the most remarkable such story belongs to another man in Hungary at that time, Giorgio Pelasca. An Italian, Pelasca found himself in Budapest during the war as an agent trading in meat. Ideologically fascist, he had fought with Franco during the Civil War in Spain, and the grateful dictator had personally signed a postcard offering him the help of the Spanish nation whenever he should call upon it. Pelasca had become disillusioned with Mussolini in his native Italy when his regime introduced race laws in 1936. Until then, Italian fascism had actually counted Jews among its membership. Pelasca had many Jewish friends. This policy of discrimination was impossible for him to accept. When the political climate changed in Budapest in 1944, Pelasca's papers permitted safe passage back to Italy, but he chose instead to remain in the city to rescue Jews. He went along to the Spanish embassy, Spain, like Switzerland and Sweden, having taken a neutral position in the war, and showed his Spanish credentials to Ángel Sambres, the charge d'affaires. Sambres had himself already begun a mercy mission by issuing Spanish identity papers to Jews, but when the political atmosphere became too dangerous, he took the decision to flee. At which point, Pelasca decided to impersonate the now absent Spanish diplomat, changing his first name to Jorge and driving around the city in the official embassy car. Sambres, in his haste to flee, had forgotten to take the official seals with him, so Pelasca deployed them to stamp as many documents as possible, issuing them to Jews desperate for a new identity. Every day he would challenge Nazi officials in the process of deporting Jews, claiming he had more authority over them and insisting they must be handed over to his responsibility. On one occasion, he rescued two boys who were about to be deported to a concentration camp and put them in his car. A young German major drew his pistol and aimed it at him. The standoff ended when a lieutenant colonel intervened and ordered his subordinate to forget it, telling him that they would get them later in any case. Unknown to Pelasca at that time, the commanding officer was Eichmann. In time, Pelasca learnt of a plan by the Arrow Cross to round up all the Jews under diplomatic protection in Budapest, to incarcerate them in the main ghetto, and to set fire to the buildings. Still posing as Sambres, he telephoned Hungary's interior minister and threatened to have the 3,000 Hungarians living in Spain interned and their property confiscated, adding that he'd also encourage the Brazilians, Argentinians, and Uruguayans to follow suit if this barbaric act was not stopped. The Hungarian minister backed down, unaware that there were in fact fewer than 100 Hungarians living in Spain at that time. Pelasca rescued some 5,000 Jews. When the war ended, he returned to Italy and disappeared. Until 43 years later, when a journalist, encouraged by a group of women whom Pelasca had saved, tracked him down to his hometown of Padua, where he was living in quiet retirement with his wife and children. Uncomfortable with the sudden attention, Pelasca was officially honoured by Italy, Israel, and Hungary. But one elephantine question remained unanswered. The journalist asked, "Why? You could have fled this inferno at any time. You stayed for a whole year. Why?" His response was reflexive and as deep as the ocean. "I did what any human being would have done."
A Murmuration of Starlings. Some say that those we have loved and lost, the million, million who have gone before, come out at dusk to relish body time again, and rush about in most curious murmurations. Once I heard a high-pitched cry from the birth room, a wail of loss from the other where and otherwise, and I would have caught the helpless newborn to me, enfolded and warmed it, but I could not. And once I heard from somewhere, out in the night, amongst junked backyards and suburban sideways, a fox, that once masterful creature, bark out of his fox sorrow, suffering weathers and bin-lid indignities. I know we too are but dry bones, bleached and brittle, our hold being tenuous at best. Starlings, they say, can mimic in song the best a bird can do, but their own performances are in massed choirs at dusk, flinging themselves in a million million about the sky, sachet shimmering, a mixum gatherum ruffle up of wings before the roost. They form sentences from the afterlife that are wholly indecipherable. Paragraphs like night itself, shattering and regrouping. Now whale shape or dromedary, now a heart. The fling and furiousness of the mystery. Perhaps it has little to do with roosting. Nothing to do with wooing and courtship, birthing or dying. Perhaps it is a carefully choreographed ballet of acclaim. Hosanna, alleluia to the glory of birdhood, to the wonder of updraft and sky, wings and treetops, to the great all-maker who is, in multiple, a starling.
On this morning's mix of new and recent archive scripts, we heard The Old Castle Bell by Amanda Bell, Ballanderry by John McKenna, One for Everybody in the Audience by John Toll, Exposure by Brian Farrell, Blackberry Picking by Kathy Donaghy, Perlaska by Oliver Sears, and A Murmuration of Starlings, a poem by John F. Dean. The music was Do You Love an Apple by the Bothy Band, The Lark in the Clear Air played by Geraldine O'Grady, To Whom It Concerns by Chris Andrews, I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing by the New Seekers, Songs My Mother Taught Me by Dvorak, played by Joshua Bell, and an extract from Zay, composed by Jeff Hamburg and sung by Judith Mock with the Amsterdam Sinfonietta. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.